I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you enjoy listening to the LRB podcast, then you'll probably enjoy reading the LRB. You can subscribe to the LRB from just £1 per issue. To find out more, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen. Or click on the link in the description below this episode.
Welcome to the LRB podcast. I'm your host, Adam Schatz. My guest today is Jesse McCarthy, the author of an arresting new book of essays on Black literature, art, and politics, Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul? Jesse is a professor of English and African American studies at Harvard. He's also an editor at The Point, where many of the essays first appeared. His first novel, Fugitivities, will be published in June. Jesse is one of the most elegant and incisive writers on Black diasporic culture today, steeped in history and tradition, but equally conversant in contemporary culture, from the art of Kara Walker and Kehinde Wiley to hip-hop and trap music. Jesse, thanks for joining us today on the LRB podcast.
Hi, Adam. Thanks. It's really great to be with you.
Now, you can't tell a book from its cover, but the cover of your book is, in fact, a succinct and expressive guide to your preoccupations. I'd like to start by asking you about the haunting image of Juan de Pareja, a former slave who became a painter, by Velázquez. Tell us a little bit about this Juan de Pareja.
So Juan de Pareja was an assistant, but also an assistant to Velázquez, but also an enslaved person of African descent, working in Spain, originally from Sevilla. And, you know, I first came across, I would say, his image at the Met. There's this absolutely magnificent portrait of de Pareja that you can go see in the Met in New York City, hopefully once it's open again, or maybe it is open again.
It is.
And so it's an image that I'd actually seen before, but never really thought that much about or sort of fully considered and taken the implications of. And in a sense, I think didn't really understand what I was looking at when I was looking at that painting. But it's always sort of stayed with me. It was sort of in the back of my mind, I think. I won't say that it haunted me. That would be to overstate things. But it lingered there in my mind. And eventually, I came around to wanting to know more about who the subject was of this great Velázquez painting that's here in New York City. And that led me down a path of research and discovery. And fundamentally, what it made me realize was just how terribly ignorant I was about Black diasporic life in Spain, particularly in the 16th and 17th centuries. When in fact there was this incredibly rich culture and there was an enormously large population of enslaved Africans who were in the process of forging a kind of diasporic culture. It was deeply infused with Catholicism, and it was a very complicated world, right, in which there were many different ways of experiencing enslavement. In many ways, de Pareja would have been someone who was experiencing, in a sense, a kind of quote-unquote more privileged position in the sense that he was, you know, assistant to Velázquez, which meant that he had a kind of a lifestyle within the court because Velázquez was very much a court painter. But at the same time, of course, he was regarded by the standards of the time as someone who had no business being an artist. And in the way that, for example, we understand the phrase liberal arts, the arts were reserved for for libres, for free persons. And so initially, even though De Pareja was an extraordinarily able assistant, and even though he made it quite clear that he himself was interested in painting, that was sort of an absolute no. Up until, and there are sort of, I think some of these stories are somewhat apocryphal, but there are stories that essentially, one day, Velázquez, the master, comes in and sort of sees the work and, realizes how talented this assistant is. But also they travel together on a trip to Rome, and Velázquez has a papal commission. And allegedly the painting that we have was actually intended originally as a study, but it turned into such a kind of masterwork. For whatever reason, Velázquez put such a kind of fine touch to it that upon seeing it, there was this sort of great acclamation, and everyone was curious about who the sitter was, who the subject was. Upon learning that it was his enslaved assistant, they recommended that he be released, and Velázquez did eventually manumit him. And so he acquired his freedom and outlived Velázquez and was a painter in his own right. And I think in a sense, this was actually for me the kind of hinge, the turning point that really drew me into this story, was because I think initially even though I understood that he was a black subject of Velázquez's artistry, I didn't understand that Pareja himself was an artist, was a painter. And the fact that he was himself a painter really fascinated me. And so it led me naturally to ask the question, well, what was his art like? How did he understand what it meant to paint and to make art as someone who had had the life trajectory that he had?
And to make art within the school of the man who had been his owner.
Absolutely. Absolutely, right? Like very much in the shadow of the master, and in more senses than one. Because of course, Velázquez is literally his master in the sense of owning him as property, but is also, a master in the sense of, the master craftsman, in the sense of making a masterpiece, one of the world's great painters. And so, that kind of critical problem became fascinating to me. How do I read a painting by De Pareja? How do I make sense of it? How do I evaluate it as a contemporary critic in this moment? And that sort of led to the subject, the meditation, if you will, of the first essay in this collection.
And the title of this essay, which is a really brilliant meditation on the relationship of Black diasporic art to Western culture, is The Master's Tools, which is an allusion to Audre Lorde's famous remark that you can't destroy the master's house using the master's tools. And you put forward, I think, a subtly subversive critique of that notion.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'll say this. I think that it's important to see those, this extremely famous quote by Audre Lorde in context. And in its context, Lorde is really discussing some of the specific problems that she's encountering when she's in spaces where, as a Black woman and as a lesbian and as an activist, she would expect, and in particular in the context of these remarks, which I believe were originally given in 1977, I might be mistaken, but it's right in there, it's in the late 70s, at a conference that was largely attended by white feminists, which is sort of the most immediate audience, not the only audience, but the most immediate audience for these remarks. She's talking about the ways in which the feminist movement of the time, which was largely, certainly in her view, dominated by white women, and therefore the interests and agendas and sort of political orientations of that particular demographic. She felt that they, while they wanted to emancipate themselves from certain aspects, had not sufficiently interrogated some of the ways in which they were, in fact, still invested in reproducing
capitalist and patriarchal structures and racial ideology.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think taken in that context and, you know, and understood in that light, you know, Audre Lorde is making a very, very important critique. In a way, what I'm trying to do is I'm thinking a little bit about how I regard some of the binds that I think we find ourselves in the contemporary moment. I think we're in a slightly different moment now than we were in the 1970s. And, you know, I think there's a lot of healthy debate about this. And, you know, I'm mostly interested, you know, in a sense with this collection, even in general, in creating and generating more conversations and more debates. I'm not, interested in forcing people to a view or trying to say that everyone should think as I do. But I do think that it's my sense that there are sometimes people who seem to chafe at the notion that anything or any tradition that doesn't, you know, line up completely with sort of the positionality that you already inhabit is to be treated, well, certainly as suspect, which might be fair enough, but also potentially as something to be discarded, ejected, or rejected. And I think actually there's a great deal of subversive power in taking just the opposite tack on that. And in a sense, though, it's complicated because, and this is why the story with Desprez was particularly interesting to me. You know, what I say in the piece is that when I investigated Desprez's painting, one of my initial reactions was actually one of kind of disappointment. Because I was looking at these paintings and I think I was invested affectively and emotionally in wanting them to do something, in wanting to see in them some kind of resistance, some kind of way in which he was grappling with his former master and kind of
his subjecthood.
That's right, his subjecthood. And I don't know what I imagined, but I think I was hoping secretly inside to feel something like that. And that's not what I found. And so my initial reaction to the paintings was a kind of disappointment in them. But the more I actually spent time educating myself, the more I spent time learning about the communities that he actually inhabited, the codes and the ways in which, in that particular time and place, people were thinking about and rethinking, for example, Christianity and Christian iconography. This is a time when, for example, the church incorporates for the very first time Black saints, right? And so there was all this kind of context that I had not sufficiently, you know, thought through. And once I started to really come to see De Pareja in his own context, as it were, to try and get into his own perspective, I realized that it was simply that I couldn't see some of the moves that he was making.
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to be, you know, Kerry James Marshall or Robert Colescott. He's, you know, more of a Phyllis Wheatley-like figure.
In a sense. But to me, one of the things that's very important, and this is sort of where I come out in the essay, is that I say, you know, at the end of the day, it's not simply about reproducing the, you know, master-slave dialectic, but it's rather that a different perspective actually affords, you know, a shaft of light, a beam into some aspect of the human experience that someone else might not have. And that no one, in fact, has the totalizing gaze, the totalizing view. And so, of course, Velázquez is a great master. He'll always be a great master of painting. And to a certain extent, I'm not even arguing that De Pareja is as great a painter as Velázquez. But what I'm saying is that there are things that Velázquez could see and understand that De Pareja couldn't. But there are also things that De Pareja can see. He has a vision of the world, and in particular, an understanding of the relationship between vocation and freedom, between what it means to make art and what it means to kind of self-fashion, right? And even just a kind of ontological conception of freedom that Velázquez's painting, you know, for all of its greatness, you never get that sense. He has no conception of that.
You write in your conclusion to the essay that the hand of the slave who wields the master's tools inevitably transforms them. New keys can unlock new doors that open onto unsuspected basements. Velázquez had the tools of a master. He didn't have the vision of a slave. Now, interestingly, as you point out, De Pareja appears in one of Velázquez's most famous paintings, Las Meninas, which is the subject of the opening chapter of Foucault's book, The Order of Things, and yet Foucault never mentions him.
Yeah, you know, and I think this was also, you know, of course, in a bit, I wouldn't even say in the back of my mind, but this is part of what I was grappling with. And in a sense, the essay, you know, I'm wanting for De Pareja to wrestle with Velázquez, but I'm also wrestling with Foucault here a little bit. And what I'm trying to, again, suggest in a kind of parallel fashion is that for all of, you know, the powerful framework and the very powerful insights that have come down to us, you know, from the Order of Things and from Foucault's great works, there are also these very interesting blind spots, right? And again, part of what I'm saying is, look, I've learned a great deal from reading Foucault. And, you know, I've, you know, in a sense, like De Pareja, right, absorbed to a certain extent the lessons of the master. But it's also important to see that, you know, my vision of the world, the angle that I come at things, I might see some things that he doesn't see, right? And when I say, you know, I don't mean just me personally, you know, Jesse McCarthy, the essayist, but I'm suggesting actually, like, in a sense, an entire new, you know, wave of criticism and of critics, I mean, you know, who are working today and who are, I think, changing the way we have conversations about race and art and culture and politics.
And it seems to me the argument that you make about the transformation of the tools by the person who is a subject or who has experienced subjugation is in some sense the story of Black American literature. When you think about Du Bois's relationship to the Western philosophical tradition, or Richard Wright's relationship to Dostoevsky, or Baldwin's relationship to Henry James. I mean, or you'd never mistake Toni Morrison for Faulkner, and yet she's clearly drawing upon and transforming those tools.
No, I think that's completely right. You know, it's interesting. We've sort of had just recently this, I don't want to call it a scandal, let's say an uproar, because Howard University, which is an extraordinarily important historically Black university here in the United States, had moved to eliminate its classics program. Drawing protests from Cornell West, but also drawing protests from the Black student unions and Black student groups at Howard. That's to say, you know, this is not actually something that was endorsed or pushed by the students, you know, counter to some of the people who wanted to frame it as an issue of quote-unquote cancel culture. But at the same time, you know, one of the things that I think it might have been Eddie Glaude who mentioned it at one point, he was being interviewed or asked about this question. He pointed out, you know, Toni Morrison, who went to Howard University, you know, what did she major in? She majored in classics, right? And that comes as no surprise to anybody who's a serious reader of her work, because her work is infused with that background and that learning. And in some ways, the analogy that I'm making here is very apt. That is to say that, you know, there's a, particularly in Beloved, but also in many of the other fictions, there's a strong sense of her reworking and in some sense reinstating tragedy as a form that is native to her own needs, ends, and experiences. And I think that that's a sort of, you know, a magnificent example of precisely this notion that I'm getting at of, as soon as you pick up the tool, you actually change it. And that change, as I say, is accompanied by a vision. And you know, that different vision has a whole suite of implications that are aesthetic, that are ethical, and also, of course, political.
I think this is probably why the great painter Kerry James Marshall titled his exhibition at the Met Breuer, Mastery.
That's right.
But I want to talk about another master, Gil Scott-Heron, because it's from Gil Scott Heron that you derive the title of your book, Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul? It's also the title of one of the essays in the book, which is a thought-provoking and very searching critique of the argument for material reparations for slavery. You're not unsympathetic to the demand, or for that matter persuaded by some of the glib attacks on the idea of reparations, and yet you suggest that Gil Scott Heron puts his finger on a problem that reparations just can't address. Can you unpack that a bit?
First of all, I mean, you know, Gil Scott Heron was an artist that, you know, I've been listening to for a very long time. His record, Small Talk at 125th and Lenox, was one of these records that I had as a teenager. And, you know, I've listened to it over and over again. And he was sort of one of the people who kindled an early interest in poetry, for example. And I always loved this particular song, Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul. And so I always had that, you know, that refrain in the back of my mind. And when it came time to think of a title for the book, it seemed like a natural fit to me. In no small part because Gil Scott Heron, who's in many ways, you know, kind of considered sort of a godfather to the you know, rap and hip hop movement because of his role as kind of bridge, a kind of spoken word artist, bridging kind of the spoken word tradition, kind of the last poets, but also kind of working with hip hop artists later, including even Kanye West. They collaborated at one point, but also someone who was, you know, famous for his kind of intellectualism and his, his engagé politics. And so this was somebody who, for me, you know, the kind of constellation of interests were the constellation of interests that I want, that I see as kind of at the core of the book, at the core of the collection as a whole. The only problem is that, you know, once you have the word reparations in the title, I think, you know, I worry that a lot of people are going to be disappointed because they pick up the book thinking maybe that they're going to get, you know, like a knockdown argument in the debate about reparations. And in a sense, I'm actually not that interested in kind of in the debate, in the kind of positioning, you know, are you for or against reparations? You know, give me the knockdown argument. I'm actually much more interested in complicating the question as such, and really asking what I think are some important underlying questions about, you know, what could ever constitute repair? What could ever constitute redress? What are the terms that are appropriate or inappropriate for thinking through how you fix something of that order, of that magnitude?
Something that really can't be fixed, even if material reparations were ever given.
That's right.
Wouldn't that also suggest that the problem has been, quote unquote, solved, which would also be an illusion?
I think that's exactly right. And so when I initially, you know, wrote this essay, it was as a response to Ta-Nehisi Coates's now sort of classic article essay in The Atlantic, The Case for Reparations. And again, I think I should make clear because, you know, too often, sometimes it can feel in the public sphere as if Black intellectuals are sort of pitted against each other. And that's always been, it's been very important to me always, even when I have disagreements, and I have disagreements, sometimes sharp disagreements, that, you know, I'm not interested in taking anybody out, taking anyone down. I have enormous respect for Ta-Nehisi Coates as a writer, as a thinker, as an intellectual. And I think that he did an enormous service to the conversation by writing that piece.
This is one of the qualities I really admire in these essays, Jesse, which is that you're not a polemicist. It seems to me that you're more interested in what Deleuze called lines of flight than in exposing someone or calling them to account.
No, that's absolutely right. And so for this is a perfect example where, on the one hand, I'm perfectly happy to agree with folks who think there should be some form of material reparations. But what I want to do is interrogate what I think is a kind of underlying, you know, logical and ethical problem here, which is that, as I see it, you know, once you, as I say, sometimes to be glib, I say to people, you know, well, go ahead and put a dollar amount on it. You know, and once I ask you to put a dollar amount on your ancestors, I think you start to get a little uncomfortable. And I want to rest with that discomfort. I want to interrogate that. Why does it make you so a little bit uncomfortable to put a dollar amount on how much you know, you're, that is worth. And I think that, to me, that's where we get to this underlying thing of, wasn't that the original sin, quote unquote, to put dollar amounts on human beings, to imagine that human life is fungible, right, and quantifiable, and that we can simply deal with problems through transactionality.
So basically kind of responding to the historical commodification of Black people by recommodifying them.
That's right. And in a sense, you know, what I'm interested in is asking the question of, well, what about all the ways in which I might say, you know, the things that were done that were wrong, I refuse that currency of redress, right? I don't accept that I can be paid off for it in the currency that you can also use to buy a car, or that you can also use to buy a house, or whatever the case may be. I think there's something of a different order that's involved here. This is an example that I wish I had included in the essay, but I wasn't actually aware of it at the time, but that I use when I discuss this now a lot. In 1868, William T. Sherman actually signed a treaty with the Sioux Nation to protect the Black Hills, which they considered as sacred land to them as a tribe. But and as was with the case with so many of those quote-unquote Indian treaties, within 10 years, settlers had violated the terms of the treaty, occupied the lands, exploited them for resources, and the Sioux Nation lost control over the sacred ground that is of terrible importance to them as a people. Well, you fast forward after in part because of the insurgency of the American Indian movement in the 1970s, in 1980, there's actually a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. U.S. Supreme Court takes up this question of the violation of the Treaty of Fort Laramie, 1868, and they find in favor of the Sioux Nation. Mm. And they say, you know, this was wrong. The government had no right to, they violated a good faith treaty. The Sioux Nation must be awarded damages. And the U.S. Treasury established a fund for reparations for the Sioux Nation. And they put, I think it was $130 million or something in this pot. The Sioux Nation refused the money. Today, that pot is worth well over $1 billion. It's been collecting interest over the decades. The Sioux Nation refuses to take it. Now, maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. We can have various arguments. But my point is that very act of refusal is the one that I want us to think about. You know, I want us to rest and think about what it means when people say to you, you know what? What I asked for was my sacred land, and that is not a fungible thing. That's not up for trading.
That's your value system, not ours.
Exactly.
You know, your whole book, I think, turns on a series of questions that you pose in your introduction. You write, what do people owe each other when debts accrued can never be repaid? What role does culture play in a society governed in such a way that its historical inequalities are continually reproduced and widened, and its moral insolvency perpetually renewed? What do those owed nevertheless owe to each other? And what possible role can art or literature play under those conditions?
You know, this is the thing. I think many people right now can feel that we're in a moment of crisis. But in a sense, particularly from an African-American perspective, we've always been in a moment of crisis. What I think feels more particular about the moment that we are in is that so many people feel a sense of rudderlessness. They feel a sense of hopelessness. There's a great deal of despair. There's also a great deal, there's this kind of feeling that we've reached a kind of aporia. We've reached this impasse. And there's this sense that we're stuck in neutral. And one of the things that I think I'm trying to do is to suggest that, you know, culture can't solve things. But then again, I'm not sure anything can quote unquote solve things. I think that we have, as Americans, we have this desire, we have this pragmatism. I think in reparations comes out of this impulse. We're like, can I just sign a bill? Can I just send somebody a check and then we'll be good? We'll move on, right? When life doesn't work like that?
Yeah, in that sense, a lack of feeling for the kind of tragedy that Morrison is reinstating. This sunny kind of solutionism.
Exactly. Solutionism, which is so false and so shallow. And I think here culture has a role to play because, in a sense, culture has a longer time horizon It looks forward. It looks backward. It's a connective tissue, and it reminds us of other orders of value, right? For example, the tragic, but also the comic. I would call it sort of the earthy sort of perseverance of the blues.
Or Afrofuturism with its other planes of there, as Sun Ra used to say.
That's right. And you know, acts of radical speculation, right? But it's always about tapping into orders of value that are not necessarily, that don't necessarily feel tangible in the order that you walk outside and encounter every day, right? And I don't want this to sound facile, like, you know, well, we just have these resources to reimagine, and it's sort of this well. I mean, I think it actually is that. But it's also that culture is what human beings necessarily make together. It is by definition, a kind of collective endeavor, and it imposes and implies collective meanings and destinies. And I think that part of what I'm interested in, and this is getting to a kind of meta-argumentative level here, but I feel like both in our politics, in our intellectual discourse and conversations for, let's say, the last 40 years, there's been a process that, you know, we might broadly call one of kind of deconstruction. There's been a phase of critique of a lot of the kind of dominant assumptions that, you know, the dominant sort of hegemonic Western powers held, and that held fast sort of up until the 60s, roughly, let's say. And I think that that phase of deconstruction was incredibly important, and I think it was historically necessary. That is to say, I don't think there was any way to avoid the kinds of reckonings that happened there, as violent, as unpleasant, as disturbing, but also as exciting, as revolutionary, and as emancipatory as they all were. But I also think that that orientation, that deconstructive approach, is beginning to look exhausted. And you can tell that, I think, in part because those who oppose it already anticipate it now. There's a way in which it's almost, I would say, sort of too easily countered.
And also to some extent because of its insertion into bureaucracies, the kind of sterile aspects of this deconstructive move.
Absolutely. You could say that in a sense it's sort of been institutionalized and rendered, you know, rendered perhaps even a little bit formulaic. The culture, in a sense, has absorbed it, I think, and comprehended it, therefore taking its radical edge off. And it's my view, and I, you know, again, I could be wrong, but it's sort of how I approach things, at least at the moment, is that I think that we're in a kind of in-between moment where we're trying to shift out of a phase of deconstruction into what I like to think of as a moment of reconstruction. And for me, the important echo there is, of course, historical. That is, the reconstruction of the 1870s, the reconstruction that ought to have brought freedom and equality to African Americans in the United States, but was violently opposed and overthrown, and therefore never, you know, never took place, never could fulfill its ambitions.
The aborted revolution.
That's right. The aborted revolution, which was picked up again in the civil rights movement and again violently opposed and in many ways undermined and sapped from within, and, you know, and has left us where we are, where once again we are at this kind of impasse, and we have to face the fact that the work of reconstruction is yet to be done, and that we can't have this backwards look of, oh, but we did the civil rights movement, and so now we just have to iron out the wrinkles or something. No, this is not about ironing out some wrinkles. We actually still have to undertake the wholesale rebuilding of a culture that is properly integrated, of a socio-political order that is just, of a society where the genuine kind of plurality of needs and voices and interests that make the American nation so so interesting and so compelling, so exciting to so many people, though in many ways very nightmarish for many of the people who live in it, that can be properly given what I think is ultimately its historical, you know, direction. And this is sort of also my thing, is that, you know, the momentum I think is there. You know, I think people, you know, we always have these debates. You know, I think the momentum, the line of momentum is clear. The question is, though, and maybe the harder realization, right, is that this is hard work. It involves a lot of effort. It involves doing things that we don't really want to do. We're not even really good at as human beings in a certain kind of way. Self-examination is not actually our strongest suit. Delusion is, for the best of us, including intellectuals, right, is actually oftentimes what we're best at. And so, you know, this has been an arduous road, and we're probably not even close. But I do think that I hope that we can turn to the culture that we have already produced, that we are producing right now, and that the kind of culture that I see on the horizon. I think a lot of the keys are there. And part of what I'm always very invested in is making sure that people are taking that culture seriously, because unfortunately, one of the legacies of white supremacy in the United States is that far too often that culture is not actually taken seriously. It's not taken seriously at a kind of intellectual level, at a critical level. It's you know, too often dismissed or given a kind of shallow treatment, when in fact, I think there are incredibly important messages. You know, messages was a word that Du Bois was very fond of, that Black people had a message for the world. And I think that, you know, people, even people of good faith, sometimes think that they're listening, but, you know, as James Baldwin says, far too often, they're not actually hearing, though. They're not actually listening to the message.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You started writing these essays in 2014, around the time of the murder of Michael Brown and the protest in Ferguson. By the time you wrote your preface last summer, George Floyd had been kneed to death, and America had seen the largest wave of street protests in the country's history. Now, these essays take full stock of the horror, the mourning, the anger that have spread through Black America, but they're also, I think, defiantly hopeful, and not just because of the birth of Black Lives Matter and other acts of resistance, but because of what you were just describing, this flourishing of Black art making in all fields. You write at one point, it's not unreasonable to speculate that we may even have been living through what future generations will look back on as something like a second renaissance. There are certainly echoes of the Black arts movement of the 60s and 70s too, though it's less programmatic and certainly less patriarchal in its politics.
You know, it's worth remembering, of course, that, you know, the years of the Renaissance, in terms of race relations, were very violent ones, in terms of lynching, in terms of race riots. Race riots in those days were very often mobs of white Americans attacking Blacks. You can think about, for example, what happened in Tulsa, right, 1921. So you look at the Black arts movement, right? The background to that moment of very intense cultural energies and flourishing was also a time of great political violence and upheaval. Assassination, the Black Panthers, very violent and repressive state violence. You know, in many ways, even though what we've been living through has been, you know, extremely brutal, if you actually look at the figures in a certain sense, even though that's a kind of not always, I think, the best way to think about things, but you know, the violence of the 60s and the 70s was just extraordinarily brutal. I mean, you know, in some ways far worse than what we've experienced. And throughout these periods, these were moments of cultural ferment and, you know, great advancements in the arts. And I think you see something similar happening today. And I think that, you know, this is sort of one of the things that I'm suggesting, which is that, in a sense, human beings respond with the entirety of their being. And we understand better than ever that, you know, one particular bill passing, or, you know, getting one particular person in office, or getting one particular party an electoral victory over another, is not going to solve our problems. It's not
right. Just as the conviction of Derek Chauvin is not going to end police brutality any more than Barack Obama's election ended racism.
That's right. And so there are so many dimensions of our lives that are not going to be addressed by just the formally political in that sense, right? The spiritual needs of people, the emotional trials and tribulations, the expressive reaction to pain, to injustice, but also are the kind of paradoxes, if you will, of the enormous pleasures and joys that we also experience at the very same moment, right? These are things that we, I think, handle as human beings in the realm of culture, and I think that's both inevitable and one of the beautiful things about human beings. It's one of the great, I mean, thank goodness that we have that. But, I have to say, when the Chauvin verdict came in, to be honest, one of the things that I was thinking about was, I was thinking about Breonna Taylor, and I was thinking about the fact that, and this ties in a little bit to, one of the points that I'm making in the book, why the difference there, right? Why no justice for her? But in this case, we got a conviction, and underlying it, there's this kind of bitter reality, which is that one of the signal differences in these two situations was just the position of the attorney general. And so in one case, you have an attorney general who is interested in bringing charges. In the United States, for your listeners who are in the UK,
you're talking about Keith Ellison.
That's right, Keith Ellison. But the position of the attorney general in the United States is an elected position. In other words, the person who administers justice in our society is also someone who has explicitly sort of political, and personal interests. And, there's a question mark about whether that's the best way to really administer justice, but it is the way our system currently works. And unfortunately, in Breonna Taylor's case, you had, I think his name is David Cameron, you had a black but Republican attorney general who everyone knew from the get, in the same way that everyone knew that Keith Ellison was going for political reasons. I mean, essentially. I mean, I'm not saying that he wasn't personally and ethically, otherwise invested in doing so, but, there was never any question that he would break charges.
And Keith Ellison has spent his entire political career as a social justice warrior.
That's right. So it was it was foregone conclusion that he would, that there would at least be a trial. In Breonna Taylor's, it was a foregone conclusion that she wouldn't even get a trial. But to the point of my title, if you will, it's my understanding, and I may not be getting the figures exactly right here, but it's my understanding that her family was awarded in a civil suit reparations, in damages, as it were. And I think it was to the tune of $11 or $12 million. But I think, honestly, if you ask Breonna Taylor's family, if you ask her loved one who was there that night, if you ask the activists and all the people who have been fighting so hard on her behalf and for so many others like her who go unnamed in the public sphere because their cases didn't quite make it, sufficiently high into the media radar, but there are many of them. Any one of us, any of those people would, in the blink of an eye, take a trial over $12 million. Because the money is not what we wanted. The money does not make it right. The money does, her life isn't worth $12 million. Right? You can't put a dollar price on that woman's life. We can't be satisfied with handouts and then just a perpetuated scene of injustice that we know will be allowed to repeat itself because there's been no holding to account when, and there's this kind of impunity that surrounds, this exercise of violence. And so, you know, this to me is exactly my point. When I say in my essay on reparations, what we really need to be thinking about is this notion that, the political theorist Philip Pettit at Princeton, but there are many others, widely discuss the notion out of really Roman political thought and jurisprudence, but, it was ostensibly important to the foundational political structure of the United States, but of republicanism with a little r, not the big R of the political party, but which was founded in a very important way on this notion of non-domination. That is to say that every person, every subject of the state, the most important feature of that state in order for it to be meeting its responsibilities as a republic, if it wants to call itself that, is precisely that the subject and citizen must never be subjected to random violence or coercive power by the state. And what do we see in Black life today? I mean, this is emblematic of the terrible situation.
Mass incarceration, police brutality, and so on. And these, of course, are at the center of the discussion today around abolition, around defunding the police. And it seems to me, Jesse, that your book is also a very stimulating and probing response to one of the most powerful intellectual currents that have arisen in Black studies. I'm talking about Afro-pessimism. You understand and you evoke the allure, even the seductiveness of Afro-pessimism, which is not so much a school of thought as a mood, you suggest. And yet, in the end, you really mark your distance from Afro-pessimism.
Yeah, that's right. I would say this is another example, of a case where, I'm interested in engaging with what I regard to be some of the most exciting intellectual work that's being done today.
Saidiya Hartman and Fred Moten receive very admiring attention in your book.
Right. And I would say that, Afro-pessimism as an intellectual movement that is very closely associated with, Frank Wilderson, Jared Sexton, David Marriott, and many others, is an intellectual movement that, again, I think has been extraordinarily useful and important. I think that, I have my disagreements with it, but at the same time, I'm extraordinarily grateful to these people for having done the work that they've done and that they're continuing to do. And I hope that people, one of the ways in which I tried to organize the essay, which was initially a review of Wilderson's book entitled Afro-pessimism, and which sort of lays out in a kind of autobiographical or auto-theory, sort of, I think his word for it, kind of auto-theory kind of way, his ideas in part through the lens of his own life. Part of what I wanted to do was actually to make sure that, that book got seriously considered in the public sphere and got, and that those ideas were circulated and that I tried as best as I could, and to my own understanding, to articulate in good faith, those arguments. And I think they're important. And I'll say this really quickly. The ways in which Afro-pessimism in particular has forced people to think about anti-Blackness in particular, when so much theorizing and theoretical discourse in the academy, but not exclusive to the academy, has, I think, often tiptoed or danced around anti-Blackness, that's been extraordinarily productive and important. The ways in which Wilderson is interested in thinking about Blackness and the quote, the Black as the sort of dialectical opposite of the human being, right? These are really important for us to grapple with. So I'm not interested, as it were, again, in kind of dismissing, this is not about making a knockdown argument. I hope people will go out and read that work. At the same time, where I think I'm interested in adding my own voice to that conversation is that I do think that in my reading and in my view, there are a couple of things. One is that there's an enormous, I would say very, very deep connection, which all of these theorists would acknowledge. There's a deep connection to readings of the work of Frantz Fanon. And, you know, this gets into the life of intellectuals, but, you know, I have disagreements with the way in which they interpret that work with Afro-pessimism. But then underlying that, and I think at a more important level, I really think that it's important. I think there's a long-standing tradition, if I can put it this way, of insurgent Black thought that has sometimes, I think, unfairly and unjustly been packaged into this, you know, I don't know, school of hope or optimism, and is therefore vulnerable always to this kind of critique of naivete. Oh, these people, you know, they just don't sufficiently understand how bad things really are. Or they're not willing to take the overpowering ontological, you know, condition seriously enough. They're not. And, you know, and I always think, you know, it just doesn't ring true to me. It doesn't fit with actually what I hear in those voices.
And also in some of the great Black thinkers and writers, you can find flashes of both despair and insurgent hope. You could read Baldwin as an Afro-pessimist or as an Afro-optimist, and the same is true of Frantz Fanon.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. That's certainly true. It depends to some extent what paragraph you happen to be looking at. But I also think, and this is where, you know, to a certain extent, I'm putting my cards a little bit on the table in the sense of articulating, you know, what my own politics are, which is that, you know, I've always been very taken with David Walker's appeal. One of the reasons I'm interested in Walker's work is that, you know, it's not original by any means to think of him as kind of one of the founding kind of figures who articulates, you know, an early version of Black nationalism, especially in the U.S. context. But I think that Walker's text is extremely attuned, as Fred Moten and others have paid close attention to. You know, Walker is extremely attuned to abjection, you know, to what he describes as the wretched state, the most wretched, people that the world and world history has ever known. Right, he's not by any stretch of the imagination somebody who's sort of looking at things through rose-tinted glasses. This is not a naive thinker. And yet at the same time, it's Walker who says to us, and here he's arguing against the emigrationists. He's arguing against those who faced with the kind of implacable violence of white supremacy. We're talking about the eight, you know,
who seek to flee.
Seek to flee and essentially to say, and to abandon the ship. You know, there's this, we have to get out. This is the 1820s, right? Extraordinarily violent time. In this moment, in the moment of 1828, 29, when he's composing and publishing the appeal, he has this ability to say, this country is more ours. And by ours, he means specifically African Americans. He says, this country is more ours than it is the whites, right? He says, we've put our blood and our tears into the soil, and we will not be moved, right? We will never allow you to make that pain, that sacrifice, that endurance, we will never allow that extraordinary sacrifice and experience to be rendered null, right? We claim that. We claim that as part of our identity. And we insist that this nation must be made right for us. And this is what I'm always trying, you know, it's something that I'm
right, and that this abjection is not just a part of our history, it's a part of your history. And you find echoes of this argument in Ellison and Albert Murray and Baldwin and Toni Morrison.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, but one of the things that I'm at pains to say to folks is you have to understand that the African-American, I'm saying that specifically because Walker himself already has a really rich, you know, understanding of diasporic Blackness. But African-Americans in particular have long understood that we have, you know, we have this extraordinary background there's a part of us that has a kind of built-in spiritual worldliness because we understand ourselves as descendants of Africa, but also in a sense because of the slave trade, not only of Africa, right? I mean, blackness was spread globally. The Arab slave trade spread blackness into the Indian Ocean. You know, the vast majority of Africans were deported to Brazil, right? And to into Latin America, Latin and Central America. Extraordinary black populations in Mexico. And of course, most importantly, perhaps, in certain respects, the Caribbean. Haiti, of course, Jamaica, and go on and on. So we have this kind of built-in worldliness, but we also specifically as African Americans understand that our situation in captivity in a white supremacist republic with its deeply conflicted and confused, you know, enlightenment ideals has placed us in a situation where we don't have some other place to fall back to. We have to make it work here. And so when people enter into defeatist modes of argumentation and defeatist modes of, you know, throwing one's hands up in the air, I think there's a lot of black folk who say, you know, that's not a position that folks who have children can afford to adopt because we want something better for them. I think that we have a profound sense of our relationship to those people who got us to where we are. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, things being owed and we talk about all of this stuff, I think a lot of African Americans feel a great sense, a very deep sense of obligation and responsibility to the people who somehow got through what they had to get through for us to even be around. And I think there's a part of us that considers that and thinks, you know, we can't allow for that effort to not be given meaning. We can't allow for that sacrifice, that endurance, that perseverance to not be transmitted forward. It can't be that all of these generations have done what they had to do, and then it got to us, and we just said, it's white people. What can you do? You look at the structural problems; it'll never change. The best thing we can do is just kind of huddle together and wait for the end of the world, and you know, kind of move into a mode of kind of almost theological resignation. You know, maybe in the next life. No, I think we feel that, you know, Du Bois had this conviction that regarded in a certain light, part of what had happened to black people in the United States of America was the emergence of what he called a world historical people. And yes, there's a kind of way in which this imposes a, you know, kind of teleology that I know, you know, we feel frustrated by and people, you know, I think are rightfully, you know, often frustrated with sort of the politics and certainly the sort of kind of cultural politics of uplift and all of that. But at the same time,
a myth can be false and also quite useful.
A myth can be false and useful, but it's also true that an enormous amount was achieved. You know, and black people are enormously proud of the things that we have achieved. We're enormously proud of our culture. We're enormously proud of our artists, of our intellectuals, of our thinkers, of our philosophers. We're also enormously proud of ordinary, everyday men, women, children, young people who have, borne incredible burdens and also, you know, built and rebuilt communities. I say to people, you know, people talk about Tulsa, you know, which was this absolutely terrifying massacre, destruction of an entire black neighborhood, destroyed precisely because it was successful, it was thriving, it had a kind of great center of black business. But part of that story that is sometimes not emphasized and not told is that within a few years, Black Tulsa, that Black business district, had been rebuilt by Black people, by the same people. And, you know, and that, I guess I'm always at pains to say, you know, I'm not trying to say that, I'm not trying by any stretch of the imagination to de-emphasize that moment of violence. And to the extent that people are ignorant of that, that they don't know that history, that they don't understand that this is what people have been up against, you don't understand the country.
But let's not forget that response, and let's not forget that resilience.
The response and the resilience have merit and also need to be voiced. And they have significance. They have significance. And the fact of the matter is that it might be that when you look at U.S. history, you step back and look at it, at its, you know, broad structure, you do see that there, you know, much of the dialectic driving its history is the problem of race, the question of these people, of these people of African descent and their place in this society. So many of our historical crises, almost all of them really, have been articulated around this problem. And you could say that that suggests that there is this sense in which we are, it's true that we are the victims of this situation, but the curious thing is that we are simultaneously the victims and in the driving seat of history. And the history and fate of the nation does turn on how we work out this problem. And I mean, if this seems obvious, I mean, if you just look at what we've gone through in the last, you know, few weeks, the last couple of years, I mean, it's so strange to me that we try so hard to avoid what is so self-evident.
Jesse, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you about this remarkable collection of essays. Thanks so much for being my guest on the LRB podcast.
Thanks, Adam. This has been great. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. You can find a link to LRB pieces relevant to this episode in the description below.